In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a six-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
Nobody wants to think about the end of their life or about saying goodbye to their loved ones. Most of us are lucky that we don't have to do it. But not everyone. Some of us know early enough that we have to talk about death at length. And we have to make a call because medicine can tell us what's coming. When Canada passed Bill C-14, which allows chronically ill patients to access medical assistance in dying, some of those conversations got easier. But not all of them. Today, we're going to talk about the chronically ill patients that nearly every assisted death legislation in the world has left behind. People who are diagnosed with dementia. This isn't about whether or not you believe in assisted death. In Canada, it's the law. This is about who has access to a service that's intended to ease end-of-life suffering. The questions it raises are literally some of the biggest ones we can ask as humans. How do we define life and joy? How does that change as our faculties start to desert us? If I know I'm going to lose my mind later, can I decide now to end my life when it happens? Who decides when enough of my mind is gone that it's time? And how can we ask someone to do that for us? Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. Shannon Proudfoot is a writer at Maclean's who has spent a lot of time on this issue. Hi, Shannon.
Hi there.
Why don't you start by telling us how the issue of assisted death and dementia came to your attention in the first place?
Yeah, so I've been writing about it, I guess, for about 4 years now. So I first got into the issue in 2015. I wrote a long profile of a man who lived in London named Joe Aubin, and Joe, with unbelievable rarity, was diagnosed with Alzheimer's in his late 30s. He had a genetically inherited form. His mom had had the same illness.
Wow!
It was awful. It was unbelievably awful. It was a really, really hard road for he and his wife Robin. They are extraordinary people to write about and work with. I don't know if I should zoom ahead and tell you the end of Joe's story. Is that he actually passed away just this past fall. Quite suddenly, when I first kind of started talking to Joe and Robin for the first story back in 2015, Joe very much wanted to access assisted death. He knew what lay ahead for him. He had seen his mom spend years and years in an assisted living facility. For him, he absolutely did not want that. His priority was to avoid living in a nursing home of any kind. And at the moment that we were talking and doing that story, the situation was that the Supreme Court of Canada had struck down Canada's prohibition against what we now call medical assistance in dying. So the acronym is usually MAIDS. So
right.
If I use that term, that's what I'm talking about. So we were kind of in this purgatory where the Supreme Court had said it is not constitutional to prohibit that. We're going to give Parliament a year to sort it out. As it turned out, they needed about 16 months to actually kind of get a law together and passed. So I was talking to Joe and Robin in kind of that in-between zone where Joe knew what he wanted, he knew what he didn't want, and they were talking to a lawyer to try to see if there was some way that they could set up something, some kind of legal mechanism where, because his faculties and his sort of capacity to consent were already kind of being affected by the disease pretty profoundly. And so as part of my reporting on that story, I called a man with Dying with Dignity, whose name is Nino Sekopet, and he was sort of a kind of a client services rep and also a psychotherapist, super, super interesting guy, who subsequently became my second story on medical assistance in dying. And so I called Nino because he was sort of the guy on the ground that if you had questions in this gray zone where the law hadn't come in yet, if you wanted to know what your options are, what you could do, if you wanted to take things into your own hands, or if you simply wanted someone to listen to you talk about that and not freak out,
right,
Nino was the guy you would call. And so I called him and kind of laid out the situation for him, not knowing. At the time, I was entirely naive. I didn't know anything about assisted death. I certainly didn't know how it would play out for people with dementia. And so I said, so here's what Joe wants. Here is his situation. What is available to him? And I'll never forget, Nino just flatly said nothing. There is nothing available for him. And not because the law hasn't come in yet, because he has dementia. And so that was sort of like what launched me along 4 years now of writing about MAID particularly, but also as it pertains to dementia, because it's obviously a massive public policy issue that, you know, is profound in terms of what it touches on and life and death and our relationships with people and our responsibilities to each other and what we ask of the medical profession and all these things. But I think all of those issues are really, really heightened and sharpened when it comes to people with dementia and what's known as advance requests. So the requirements for MAID for other Canadians or regular Canadians are that they be suffering grievous and irremediable medical condition. And there we sort of let people decide, define for themselves what intolerable suffering is.
Right.
That their death be reasonably foreseeable and that they have capacity to understand what they're asking for. And also that they give final consent. So immediately before doctors, you know, you are assessed by two doctors, you go through the whole process. There's a lot of bureaucracy and safeguards. But immediately before a medical professional would administer the life-ending medication to you, you need to be in a state of capacity to consent so that they can ask you right before they give you the medication, are you sure this is what you want? And you confirm what they call final consent.
Hmm.
Obviously, with people with advanced dementia, those things are no longer possible. And the sort of hitch or the kind of awful catch-22 is that if you were diagnosed with dementia, I mean, there's a few other kind of complications there that I won't get into. Theoretically, you could get MAID earlier in the progress of the disease when you still are capable of consenting. But most people with dementia, that's not when they want their life to end. Obviously, they
right.
still have a lot of good quality of life then. They would want it to be in the advanced stages, by which point you can no longer give consent. And so even as Canada passed this law in 2016, and we've, you know, had a few years of practice with it, we're still a pretty young MAID regime globally. People with dementia, and that is not the only case where advance requests would come into play. It also could come into play with something like cancer. If you had metastatic cancer that was in your brain, that could eventually affect your faculties there, or even heavy pain medications that could affect your lucidity. There are other cases where you might want an advance request, but dementia seems to be kind of the place where it has become the biggest sort of point of public debate, where there's the strongest desire for it, where that's a condition that people fear a lot. If you sort of look at polling, if you kind of ask people what possible diagnosis or future condition would distress them the most, dementia is pretty high up there. And so that's kind of where the debate over advance requests has been located.
When you talk to people like Joe and his wife, but also some of the other people that you've met while reporting this, what do their loved ones say? Because presumably if they're hoping for advanced consent to be able to receive assisted death after the disease has progressed, it would be those people making the call of I guess, when it has progressed far enough, when they've passed the threshold that they'd indicated that they wanted to go.
Yeah, it's a good point, because there are sort of different camps, I almost think of, and I don't mean that in an adversarial way. I think about the different groups of people who are affected by this, if advance requests were to exist, and the burden that is placed on them. And one is the doctors, but another is exactly what you mentioned, the family. It just happens that of all the people I've sort of interviewed anecdotally to talk about this, who were in favor, who were themselves, had been diagnosed with dementia and wanted advance requests, all of their close family members were part of the story, were very supportive and were aligned with what their loved one wanted. I am sure there are families where that is not the case, and that's an additional level of, you know, sort of emotional difficulty. But interestingly, so when Canada passed the law in 2016, there were three what they called complex circumstances that they left out, which is advance requests, which is the one that has by far gotten the most attention, mature minors, so kids who would be considered mature enough to consent, and the possibility of MAID for people whose sole underlying diagnosis is a mental condition. And what they said is, we are going to study this for the next 2 years, and we're going to come back with big reports to sort of inform Parliament on how to think about this. Those were tabled in December, and they were written by different interdisciplinary teams of academics and experts, and they're actually like remarkably compelling, clear reading. If anyone has an interest in this area, I would actually recommend reading them. But one of the things that came out of those is, so there are only four countries in the world that allow advance requests They are Belgium, the Netherlands, Colombia, and Luxembourg. Colombia and Luxembourg effectively have never done it, so they have no practical experience we can look at. Belgium doesn't keep very good records. There's not a lot of evidence there. So almost all of what we know about how this works in practice comes from the Netherlands. And what that tells us is there's really interesting evidence about family members being in favor in theory. And they ask them sort of in studies, you know, your loved one has dementia. They have an advance in those countries. They call them advance euthanasia directives, but just for the sake of consistency, we'll call them advance requests like we do in Canada. Are you in favor? And the family members, by and large, say, absolutely, yes, this is what my loved one wanted. They did not want to live like this. They have laid out their conditions for when they want their life to end. We support that. And then when they look ahead at actually following through on it, between 2/3 and 3/4 of them actually ask a doctor not to do it when it comes time to actually put it into practice.
That feels so natural to me. I think it's
it
like,
does, right?
That's how I would imagine myself feeling.
It's a lot. And people sort of will say, well, we have advanced care planning. We have advanced directives for other medical procedures. Like people have do not resuscitate orders where they say, you know, I don't want heroic measures. I have a bunch of health problems. I don't want you, you know, thumping on my chest and putting defibrillators on me and putting tubes in me. I want you to just let me go gently. And families are comfortable following through on those. And so are doctors. There is something very distinct, though, about kind of the proactive nature of MAID. It is a different thing than not giving someone antibiotics or nutrition, knowing that in a week or two, their life is going to end. It's the activeness of ending their life with MAID that kind of changes the way families and doctors seem to respond to those orders. Again, the Netherlands being the only place we sort of see this in practice and can kind of look at how it plays out.
Well, what about doctors? You've mentioned them a couple times now.
Yeah,
are they in favor? I don't want you to speak for them as a group or anything, but where do they come into play on advanced requests, especially in cases of mental deterioration?
That's been sort of one of my areas of fascination because I sort of thought, I think it was about 2 years ago, I did a big feature on a palliative care doc who decided to offer MAID to his patients, which is actually a fairly unusual decision in the palliative care community because just philosophically, palliative care is about relieving symptoms. And one of their tenets is to neither hasten death nor prolong life. And so for palliative care docs, a lot of them think MAID is a very odd fit for their kind of philosophical approach. So anyway, doctors became kind of an area of fascination for me because I thought, like, these are the people we're not talking about in this. We've spent, you know, at that point, we'd had the law in place for about a year and a half, 2 years. We talked about what it meant for patients and for vulnerable people and for families and for the idea of suffering and autonomy. And I felt like we were missing the fact that there are human beings who were professionals that we were asking to administer these drugs and be at peace with the way in which it went about. And that to me is not a thing we should ignore. But the big thing, and this again, this evidence comes from Netherlands because it's the only place we have it, is I looked a couple of years ago at some studies that sort of showed that they looked at opinions of doctors and they used the phrase, could you conceive of providing MAID to people with dementia or to people in these circumstances? And the difficulty is too, I think it's worth thinking about what late stage dementia can look like. I mean, everyone's an individual, but there are people who would be obviously suffering in a way that even a lay person can understand, who are in emotional distress or physical discomfort. And you can think of, if you're a doctor or a family member, you might have a much easier time in that case saying, yes, now is the time. These are the conditions he or she laid out. Look at the suffering there. But a lot of people with advanced dementia don't look like they're suffering. They may delight in, you know, the food that's offered to them. I talked to one man for a story who he had been diagnosed with dementia himself. And right around the time his mother was sort of, her life was ending with advanced dementia. And he said they used to go to a room in her assisted living facility and all they would do is sit in chairs and there were some south facing windows that faced an airport and they would just sit there and watch the planes take off and land. He said, you know, earlier in her life, if you had told her that would be a source of delight and excitement to her, she would have been horrified, but that was real. Like that, those were real moments of joy in an adjusted sense.
What about the case against it from a responsibility or an abuse point of view? I mean, I know that that's one of the things that often comes up when we talk about assisted death is, will it be used responsibly? You know, to your point, all the families you spoke to had loved ones that were fully supportive and were on board and were right in line with the person's wishes. But that's not always the case. And what kind of discussions happen around the potential downside of this, the potential for abuse?
Yeah, there are worries. You hear the phrasing again and again, we must protect the vulnerable. There are worries about sort of slippery slopes. I think that plays out in a number of different ways. Sort of the most extreme and I guess kind of macabre would be the idea that you might worry about a family member, you know, you would have to imagine this would be a fairly dysfunctional family dynamic, but where someone is coerced into signing an advance request or somehow encouraged overtly or otherwise for whatever reasons, because their care is a great burden financially or emotionally. You know, there are all kinds of quite, you know, dark scenarios you could play out there. But I think the maybe more pervasive concern is a more subtle one that you hear a lot from advocacy organizations like the Alzheimer's Society. And I've talked to them about this at length, which is the idea that they are very interested in talking about how life with dementia is still life and that there can be joy and meaning there. And so for them, if we as a society kind of get to a point where we just accept in a blanket way that what life looks like with advanced dementia is not worth living, they worry about that kind of upping the stigma of a disease that they already say is hugely stigmatized, and that people could maybe end up internalizing that, that maybe you get diagnosed with dementia and you might be quite fine for 10 years or more. But because you've heard so much about the horror of late stage dementia, you think, I don't want to go there. I can't do that. So I'm going to set out these terms. And there's sort of some interesting kind of concepts that come into play there that again, this report that came out in December goes through something called the disability paradox. And this I find it's a really neat concept because it's quite intuitive. If I said to you, Jordan, imagine life if you lost your right leg at the knee. What would that look like? How would you guess your quality of life would be?
Sure, I can picture.
You would probably, yeah, and you would probably rate it horribly because you would think, I don't want that to happen. I can't imagine how my life would function and would still be satisfying to me if that's what happened. But what studies show us is that if that actually were to happen to you, your actual quality of life would be much better than you think it would. And we can all kind of intuit that, right? That like we can all deal with stuff that's much worse than we thought we could deal with, and we can find meaning and satisfaction.
That's life, in fact.
Exactly, 100%. So when you apply that to something like MAID and the finality of that, and you think, you know, I want to set out conditions for my death that are X, Y, and Z because I have a very clear idea that that would be intolerable to me. That would harm my dignity. I cannot conceive of being that person in that bed requiring that level of care. But then if we were able to peer into your head or your existence when you reach that point and find that actually it's fine and you're happy, what does that, like, how do we reckon with that if we were to offer advance requests? And the thing is, with something like dementia, that is impossible. That is a black box. That person is no longer able to tell us in any meaningful, cogent way how they feel, how happy they are day to day, what their concept of suffering is. And that is why when I came out of reading that parliamentary report, I ended up just thinking, this is an impossible thing. Like, Canada is not going to be able to do this because even the countries that do permit it basically don't actually do it. And it's because of like really deep stuff. Like, we can't know what our lives will be like over a horizon that changes things for us so profoundly. So how could we put into law something that would end someone's life based on conditions they set out for a future that is basically unknowable? And that's not to say at all, like, this is what is so confounding about this. That is not to say that people who get diagnosed with dementia today and think, I loathe the idea of sitting in a bed with someone caring for me, that is intolerable to me. It doesn't matter to me if I feel okay about it then. The me of today, my real essence of myself, finds that idea abhorrent. That matters. And there is just no way to, I don't see a way anyway, to square those concerns and go forward with making our laws more liberal here.
Is there anyone in government or in opposition, I guess, that disagrees with that, that is trying to push for movement on that? Or is it just sort of these reports came out and it's a closed book for now?
It's not my sense that there's sort of political will like within Parliament to change this, but there are individual people who speak up from time to time to advocate for this, often because it's touched them directly. And so, you know, people like me listen and talk to them, and it's kind of in the air. But given like the CCA report, so it was the Council of Canadian Academies, was the group that put together these experts that did these reports, that the nature of the reports they do is that they are explicitly not asked for recommendations. So there's no part of the report that says, dear Government of Canada, this is what you should do. But what's interesting is when you read the reports and you read the evidence they gathered and the experience of a country like the Netherlands, it's very difficult not to come away with the idea that this is just never going to happen. That basically, even if Canada did change its law, that it would not be done in practice. Like, it would not be followed through on, because it's just too fraught. It's too much to ask.
What have you come away from your reporting with that applies to your own life and the choices you make with your family?
That's a big question.
Yeah, sorry.
It's okay. I love talking about this. Like, it's the wrong word to say that I love writing about an issue this heavy, because I want to be very respectful and delicate about it. It's hugely satisfying. Honestly, I don't know how to express this so that it doesn't sound trite. There was a story out of Saskatchewan last week about a patient transfer service that was, now this doesn't have to do with MAID, but it's closely linked. So follow me. A patient transfer service, which is sort of a non-emergency ambulance that was taking a man to hospice to die. He was in his final days of cancer. And because it was non-emergency, the driver said to him, hey, is there anywhere you want to stop? And I guess they do this routinely. And sometimes people want to drive by their childhood home or a favorite tree or something kind of meaningful. And this man wanted to go for ice cream. So they took him to an ice cream parlor, and he had this ice cream sundae, and this photo made the rounds that went viral that, you know, with him with a huge grin on his face, days away from the end of his life. And he declared this the best day ever because of this ice cream sundae he got. And when you write and talk to people again and again and again about assisted death, it's really hard not to kind of fixate on the little things they want, like the things that make their life meaningful. If they are accessing MAID the way they want their last days to go. And it's almost impossible not to then bounce that back into your own life and think, if that man on the way to hospice wanted an ice cream sundae and that made it the best day ever, like, maybe I need to slow down in my daily grind and think about the little tiny things that, if this were the last day of my life, would be these like specks of wonder, and you just bypass them. And I know that sounds so trite, but like, truly, and it can get a bit heavy sometimes. Like, it's a little hard to live your life thinking about what if this was my last day, but it really does kind of make you slow down and think about the tiny little moments that knit together what our life is, because those are the things that people tend to kind of quantify, and they count them like beads on a necklace when they're thinking about sort of designing their end.
I don't think that was trite at all, Shannon.
I love this subject. I find it, it's so complex. It's so human. Like, it's so beautiful. One of the experts I talked to about the report said, you know, we shouldn't necessarily think about this as burden, like the burden on doctors or the burden on family members to make a decision, because that's really like, that's love. Like, that is the weight of the responsibility we bear for each other, is making these very hard decisions, both as a society and in our individual families. And I kind of love that. I kind of love the idea that the things that are the heaviest, it's because they're the things that mean the most. And we shouldn't shrug those off. We just have to bear the heaviness, because it's what makes them mean something.
Thanks so much for sharing your time.
Thanks for letting me talk about this. It's an issue I care a lot about.
Shannon Proudfoot of Maclean's. And that was The Big Story. If you want more, including some more cheerful than this one, we're at thebigstorypodcast.ca. If you want to chat with us, we are always waiting to hear from you at TheBigStoryFPN on Twitter. You can find all of our shows at frequencypodcastnetwork.com, and you can actually find them all wherever you get podcasts. On Apple, Google, Stitcher, Spotify, or your platform of choice. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.